Now, why is that so important? You may say, as long as we are paying American farmers support for not growing food, we may not need this information. But unfortunately, America in this respect is in the minority. We have a population explosion, statisticians predict that in the year 2000, that's 30 years from now, we will have 7 billion people to feed as compared to 3 billion today, and that in the year 2030, just another 30 years later, we'll have 14 billion people to feed. Now, this kind of information gives us, as you have seen here, good information on where is the food. Where is it distributed over the world? But as it overflies urban areas, for example, like the Washington to Boston megalopolis, it will also provide us data on the urbanization, the continuous urbanization of America. How are people moving around on this globe, and where are the eaters? And these two pieces of information, where is the food and what food and where are the eaters, are the two major ingredients of what I call a resources management system. They are the two inputs into the equations of supply of food and demand by the eaters. Now, apply the same thing to timber, apply it to oil, apply it to mineral resources, and we are talking about where are the limited resources of the planet Earth and where are the consumers. We are not doing this today, but I predict that if we are not getting busy developing a system to manage this worldwide problem of resources distribution on a global scale, that the vast majority of mankind 30 years from now or 60 years from now will be engaged in a struggle for sheer survival because they are in need of the resources. Now, on the other hand, the Earth has ample resources if we only know where to find them and how to develop them. Resources, of course, come in two categories. One type of resource is the one that you take out forever, like oil. It isn't replenished. It doesn't replenish itself. Then there's the other side of resource, the other type, the plant that you seed in the spring and where you harvest in the fall, that regenerates itself. Provided you treat it well, you irrigate it well, you fertilize it well, and you don't overwork your soil. We have to understand this mechanism better. We cannot continue to rob the Earth, the spaceship Earth, of its limited resources. We know our population is exploding. We just have to get a handle on these things. And I think the space program is in an absolutely unique position to make a contribution here, because it enables us to continuously look at this entire worldwide problem. Next slide, please. I mentioned already in passing geology and mineral things. Now here you see a cross-section through a volcano, and this is another thing that a satellite can do for you. For example, it is known that quite a number of volcanoes on Earth, before they erupt, so slight increases in temperature around here. Sometimes there's a little crater leak up here, as long as the channel is plugged up. That crater leak shows slight increases in temperature a few weeks before the thing erupts. Sometimes it's the soil that gets just a little warmer. Nothing is easier than to equip the Earth's potential active volcanoes with temperature sensors and have a satellite just interrogate these sensors as it goes around to see whether everything is still in good shape and nothing to worry about. The satellite has this interrogation capability of equipment placed on the ground and delivers it virtually for free. You don't have to send people up there all the time, which may be a tiring habit if a volcano erupts only every 400 years. But there are lots of them, and every time one does erupt, it usually takes a couple of thousand lives. So it is an important problem, and monitoring by satellite is a very convenient byproduct. Another thing is, of course, by understanding the geologic structure of the Earth, we can we can provide more effectiveness for our prospecting methods. prospecting has been pretty much a hit and run or a hit and miss proposition in the past. By correlating certain formations as photographed from orbit with other known resources of some minerals, we can vastly improve the chances of making a strike if we just go to areas that look suspiciously similar to what we have. Here again, in America, of course, prospecting has become quite an art. We have a geological air survey going for many years already. We are in pretty good shape. But vast portions of the globe, like the Andes and the Hindu Kush and the Himalayas and all these vast mountain ranges, has never been surveyed. And who knows what gold mines of minerals there are. Next slide, please. Hydrology and water is another one. Here you see a cloud as photographed from orbit over Baja California and Mexico. Here's the Florida Peninsula. We are using information like this, not only for weather forecasting purposes, but also for water management. For example, in Mexico, a very interesting thing happened last year. There was a terrific rainstorm raging for a couple of days, and it threatened to overflow an earth wall that was built above two Mexican cities. And the Mexican officials got so panicky about the possibility that if the rains wouldn't subside, that this artificial lake would spill over, destroy the earth wall, and destroy the two cities underneath, that they were about to drain this lake, which would have deprived the entire area of irrigation water and of hydroelectric power for the rest of the year. Well, fortunately, a man on the Environmental Science Service Administration, SR, for which we furnish weather satellites from NASA, heard of this predicament and told him, just wait, before you drain that lake, let us take a good look at the cloud situation there. And they instructed a satellite that was hovering over the area to look into the area, provide a readout, and they came back and said, within 6 hours, the rain will stop. And that saved, well, either the two cities or the irrigation water for the rest of the season for that part of Mexico. So you see the kind of possibilities that this opens up. The next slide shows a problem that's closely related to what I just said. This is snow, as seen from satellite. You can see the outlines of the United States drawn in here just for reference. These areas are snow-covered. Now, snow, of course, melts in the spring and fills artificial hydroelectric lakes with water and constitutes an energy and irrigation resource. But usually, the guys running these lakes have no idea how much snow there is, what the runoff reserves are, so they can't do a very effective job in managing their water resources. And yet, the availability of electricity and crops depends very directly on their ability to predict this well. Theoretically, all the snow should be used up when the need of the power is over. But this just can't be done very effectively. With satellite monitoring of snow, both in thickness and surface, we can and have already provided a very, very attractive job for these people. Next slide. Well, here's another area, oceanology and marine life. There's a lot of talk and argument in the papers these days about inner space versus outer space. The question, should space get the money or the oceanographers? Well, we feel we belong very closely together. You may have read that Scott Carpenter, one of our astronauts, has become a very effective executive in oceanography lately. Just to tip you off on the potential that exists in this field. In oceanography, it is known that the deep ocean bottom is covered on an average between 1 and 3 feet of material that is predominantly organic, or at least 50% of organic origin. And this material comes from various forms of life which over millions and millions of years have died in the waters above and have sunken down to the bottom of the sea. But since this is outside of the reach of the sun, there can be no photosynthesis, no plant life, as a result, nothing to eat for the fish, no other life. So this organic material settles on the bottom of the deep ocean. Wherever there happens to be an upwelling where some of this bottom cover is welled up into warmer surface water, a miracle happens. All of a sudden, this stuff turns into a very effective fertilizer in which phytoplankton grows, helped, of course, by sunlight through the photosynthesis mechanism. And all of a sudden, you have terrific development of life forms. This, by the way, is the mechanism that created the Sargasso Sea that you've all heard about, this tremendous complex in the southern Atlantic Ocean where ships used to get tangled up in the past. Well, you have, by surveying the seas with space-taken photographs of this kind, you can identify areas where it may be promising to bring this surface stuff up, this bottom stuff up to the warmer surface and create a kind of a marine agriculture. For example, for the generation of protein. Now, I'm not saying that we are doing that from space, but the space survey in support of these kind of marine projects can be of tremendous help. So there's actually a lot of competition between the inner space and the outer space, but a teamwork that is rapidly developing here. I think 30 years from now, a much greater percentage of the world's food will be produced through this, from the sea in this fashion. By the way, the temperature gradient between the very cold water at the ocean bottom and the warm water, for example, at the surface of the Caribbean, could very well be used to directly drive the pumps that pump that colder stuff up to the surface. So this need not any external power at all. Next slide, please. Well, here's a photograph that shows a hurricane as taken from, I believe, Apollo 9. In the case of the hurricane that hit the Mississippi coast last year, what was it, Celia or Camille, it is estimated that several thousand lives were saved just by a sufficiently early warning through satellite pictures of these approaching of this approaching hurricane and the exact path it was taking. So people could be shown these pictures and say, look how serious the situation is, get in your cars now before it's too late. Weather satellites have already become a vital part in international aviation operations. Today, when you board an airliner, say to Europe, you can be assured that your airline captain has in his hands, as he leaves the ground, a satellite photo taken of the ocean coverage over the Atlantic Ocean that is not older than about half an hour. With sophisticated new measuring techniques, we are now even able to measure measure atmospheric temperatures at various altitudes, so that we can see at 30,000 feet this is the atmospheric temperature, at 50,000 it's that, etc. We have also made a very successful experiment recently to release a number of balloons to altitudes varying between 40 and 70,000 feet and just left them drift around. We carried a little radio beacon in the, underneath, and some of these balloons have circumnavigated the Earth with the winds several times, and the satellite flying overhead would always nail them down and radio to a ground station where the position of that particular balloon, as identified by this particular code or telephone number, if you will, where it was. So it enables, this very simple method enables us to measure the air movements and wind directions and wind velocities at very high altitudes. In total, let me say that I believe, in fact, we have a firm program aimed at this objective, that 5 years from now, we will be able to provide really reliable weather forecasts 3 days ahead and, shall we say, respectable weather forecasts even 10 days ahead. Next slide, please. Well, a few words about hardware. You have all heard of the space shuttle. And I mentioned a little earlier that, of course, the major stumbling block of space flight programs is still the cost of space transportation. Our next major hardware program in NASA is a vehicle that may look something like this. We call it the shuttle. It is designed to fly a cargo compartment of this size here, with a weight of the order of 50,000 pounds of net cargo, into an orbit. We take off under the engine power of a boost stage shown here, which will drive this vehicle up to about Mach number 10 times the speed of sound, and about a 40 miles altitude, at which point this thing will be burned out and the second stage will take over and keep on flying all the way into orbit until orbital speed has been attained. This stage can then stay in orbit as long as it wishes, and whenever the landing area, the takeoff area, the launching area, rolls around on the rotating Earth into the footprint area, this stage glides, it deboosts itself in orbit, glides back to the launch station, and lands there like an airplane on wheels. The booster, in the meantime, also, upon re-entering the atmosphere, turned around. It has two jet engines that are pulled into the fuselage during the ascent, and they're now extended like a landing gear, and with these jet engines, the thing flies back also to the launch base. At the launch base, the two units are re-stacked, put together again, fueled, and they can fly up again. So this vehicle will drastically do away with our present, rather costly method of throwing the whole airplane away every time we go into orbit, which, of course, is obviously a very costly way of running this. This will be a reusable vehicle, and it can make this flight maybe 100 times, maybe 500 times. Next slide, please. Here you see the staging point where the booster engines burn out, begins to re-enter the atmosphere, the orbiter pushing on into orbit with its own engines. Next slide. You see that this thing has straight wings. It can also be built with delta wings. This has certain advantages to build it this way. It also has certain disadvantages. In our present studies, in which some major aerospace companies are participating, are presently trying trading off the pros and cons of this solutions here. You see the rocket engines of the orbiter here. You see the rocket engines of the booster here. And these are the jet engines, the air-breathing jet engines that are used for the cruise of the booster back to base. Next slide, please. Just to give you an idea of the size, this is a Saturn V. This, for comparison, is the C-5A airplane. This is the SST, the supersonic transport that Boeing is presently building, Congress willing. And this is the space shuttle that I was talking about. This, you see, it is in the order of magnitude of dimension-wise of these vehicles. Next slide, please. Here you see another configuration of this, the orbiting portion of the shuttle during the re-entry. Note that it re-enters during the hypersonic flight phase, the high-speed flight phase, at a very high angle of attack. This reduces the time of re-entry and therefore the heat pulse that must be absorbed by the skin. This is, of course, a very major consideration for a reusable vehicle, because unlike the Apollo command module, which solves this problem with an ablating heat shield, we have a metal airplane now that must really take this heat punishment and take it 100 times. So there will be no more ablation or anything like that. The skin just has to take it. Capabilities of such shuttle: satellite placement, return, repair, and service satellites, delivery of propulsive stage and satellites to low Earth orbit and transfer to synchronous orbit or escape, short duration science and applications missions. We can also use it as a research laboratory. We can use it for space rescue, get some marooned astronauts out of orbit, and finally for propellant delivery for flights onto the moon and the planets. Next slide, please. Here you see what such a space shuttle would do if it was to supply a second-generation space station. Remember the Skylab with which I started my presentation, with its orbital solar panels here. Well, here's how the reusable shuttle would arrive. Cargo, passengers would transfer into the space station. Maybe another crew wants to be relieved, goes back to Earth. I am convinced that 10 to 15 years from now, students will be able to fly with this vehicle up to orbit to get their PhD thesis worked out in orbit. They will return to Earth to write the paper and get their degree, pretty much like people are doing it today in Antarctica. Because you will not, as a student, have to pick up your own cab for the fare. Presumably the National Science Foundation will give you a grant that finances your transportation, just like it is done today if you want to study the aurora in Aurora Australis or the love life of the emperor penguin or something like this. You go to Antarctica, the National Science Foundation grant takes care of you. Well, just the same way we will conduct research in space. And that research will involve astronomy or meteorology or Earth resources or prospecting or crop surveys, or it will be in the communications field, educational television and so forth. We think there's a great future for this. Due to the ability of the space station to continuously look down at ourselves. Next slide, please. Now, I talked a great deal about the Earth and what we're going to do for the Earth from a space station, manned or unmanned, and why I believe that this is a very, very relevant thing considering our pressing problems of ecology today. This does not mean that we are giving up the moon and the planets. There will be four more flights to the moon. Then we will probably abandon the moon for a while. We don't think that this will hurt very much, because remember, in Antarctica, there was a period when Antarctica was visited by sailing ships, and then for about 50 years, nobody came, but next time they came by steamer. And then again, they pursued some research there for a while, and then another gap occurred, and the next time they came by turboprop. Nowadays, we are flying house trailers to Antarctica directly from the University of Wisconsin to the South Pole, where the graduate students work on their doctoral thesis on some cosmic ray phenomena down there and so forth. There's nothing wrong with waiting for a new generation of transportation means to come up. I believe we're going to revisit the moon again when we have that shuttle in operation, and transportation from Earth to Earth orbit would be so cheap that a trip from there to the moon will only be a marginal additional increase to the cost of getting to Earth orbit, which will be less than 10% of what it is today. The Viking project is aimed at the planet Mars. It is one of our new programs in NASA. It is an unmanned space vehicle consisting of an orbiter, which will go into orbit around Mars and map Mars, not only in a flyby, but a continuous mapping operation from orbit as the planet rotates within the orbit. This orbiter will spin off a lander that can perform a soft landing, LEM style, on Mars surface. Inside this lander will be even a little roving vehicle that can be driven around with remote control from Earth to scoop up some lunar material that can be analyzed in here. The data can be radioed back to the orbiter, and the orbiter will radio the data or relay the data back to Earth. The launch vehicle will be a Titan III Centaur vehicle managed by our NASA Lewis Center in Cleveland. The orbiter will be managed by the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, the lander by the Langley Center in Virginia, and the tracking and data acquisition with these big 210-foot dish antennas will also be done by JPL in California, with Langley being an overall charge. We think it's a very exciting new program. The first flight to Mars with a soft lander is planned for 1975. There will be two preceding flights to Mars in 1971 and 73, involving only orbits around Mars for some preliminary mapping with much lower resolution. Next slide. Here's the orbiter of Viking in a little more detail. Solar panels for electrical power generation. High-gain antenna to beam the messages back to Earth. The cruising time of the electromagnetic waves from Mars to Earth is in the order of 35 minutes. So if you measure something in this thing and want to send a corrective signal up to the orbiting Viking, more than an hour elapses before your signal arrives there. So it's quite a problem for the poor guy who has to drive that roving vehicle on the lunar, on the Martian surface. It will have a television camera looking forward, but it takes half an hour for the picture to reach the Earth and half an hour to reach the control wheel output, reach the vehicle again. So you have to drive very, very slowly. Next slide, please. Well, this is my final chart, the grand tour to the outer planet. There's a unique opportunity every 179 years when all our outer planets are lined up on a string like this that you can visit them in one sweeping flyby operation. Now, the last opportunity of this kind was missed by President Jefferson. And it is for this reason that we in NASA are very eager not to miss the chance this time. And we have a chance in 1977 and in 79 to do this. The fact that the opportunity arises twice has mainly to do with the Earth's own position. In 1977, we'll have an opportunity to go on this green flight path. We go first, in all cases, from the Earth to Jupiter. And we use Jupiter's gravitational field to pull the spacecraft around and take it to Uranus, which will be here, and then onto Neptune. And photograph this planet, doing a flyby where a couple of hours are available for sophisticated photography and scanning with all kinds of sensors similar to those explained in connection with Earth resources to get maximum information on these planets. And then with the launch window in 1979, we can fly from the Earth to Jupiter, and in the meantime Saturn will be in the right position, so we go by the passing the planet Saturn and go on to Pluto. Pluto, by the way, is not quite in the plane of the ecliptic. For this reason, we use Saturn's gravitational field to swing it out of the plane of the ecliptic into the plane where Pluto will be. So with these four flights, 277 flights following the green flight path and 279 flights following the red one, we can cover all of the outer planets in such a scout flyby mission. A gravitational assist rendered by Jupiter, by the way, works as follows. Let me explain that in a nutshell. Jupiter, of course, is going through an orbit around the Sun at a speed of about 8 miles per second. If we approach Jupiter from the trailing end, the planet moving in that direction, then the spacecraft resides, of course, for a couple of hours in Jupiter's gravitational field. And during this time, enough of Jupiter's momentum in that direction is passed onto the spacecraft to bend its trajectory around and at the same time give it an extra kick. So this is the equivalent of firing up a rocket out here near Jupiter, with the only exception that you don't have to burn any fuel when you're out here. It is through this favor that Jupiter does us that we can shorten the flight time even to planets as far out as Neptune and Pluto to about 10 years total flight time, as compared to approximately 40 years this would take if we flew directly to these planets not using the Jupiter gravitational assist. So it is also economically, since the data acquisition system must be kept alive for a much longer period of time if we if you use the direct route, this is the way to go and a real unique opportunity. So I think it will be interesting for you to remember that in addition to all the things we propose to do for men on Earth with the space program, that by the end of the 70, we hope to have visited every one planet of our solar system. And this then is really the objective of the 1970 for NASA. Thank you.
I had it explained to me at dinner that the custom is for people to form lines at the two edges of the stage, and Dr. Von Braun will be very happy to entertain questions. So if you'd like, if you have any questions, then the procedure will commence.
Maybe I could start off. Dr. Von Braun, could you answer a question that's been puzzling me? I've read different references to the moons of Jupiter and the fact that they may have atmospheres. Their sizes are comparable in some cases to the Earth's size. Can you enlighten us any further on that?
Yeah, I don't pretend to be a great expert on the subject, but I'll try. Jupiter has a total of 12 moons, four of which are known as the Galilean moons, because it was Galileo Galilei who discovered them shortly after he got a hold of a telescope which had been invented in Holland a few years earlier. At least one of Jupiter's moons, Ganymede, is larger than the planet Mercury. And I think three others are larger than our moon. And I think one of Jupiter's moons is believed to have an atmosphere. This is established, however, only for one of Saturn's moon, a moon by the name of Titan. It has a very strong atmosphere that you can see every time Titan passes in front of Saturn. I do not know whether Ganymede has an atmosphere. I doubt it, actually. These Jovian moons are believed to have a density comparable to our Earth and our moon, which means they are a lot more dense than Jupiter itself. Some of the moons are probably possible to visit by men, others are not. It is believed that Jupiter has a very strong magnetic field. Estimates are between 10 and 100 Gauss as compared to 1/2 Gauss of the Earth's magnetic field. And there is indication that this magnetic field causes a kind of a Van Allen belt situation around Jupiter, but many, many times more powerful than the Earth's Van Allen belt. And some of the moons are staying continuously in those Van Allen belts of Jupiter, which means they cruise through a pretty lethal radiation environment all the time. There are some moons inside of it, however, and some outer moons that are far enough away from this belt. This is about as much as I know of these moons.
You made a very good case for the use to us here on Earth of the Earth orbital missions, but you didn't elaborate or mention too much about what kind of actual value we would be able to derive from the further missions to the Moon or to Mars and beyond. Are there similar kinds of benefits you might be able to project?
No, I would put it this way. We have always distinguished in scientific exploration between easily recognizable near-term missions where you can identify the payoff, where the payoff is visible as you're doing it, applied research, if you want to call it. And then there's another type of research which is aimed essentially at learning some fundamentals about mechanisms in nature. It is not possible with many of these missions to identify these purposes now. But let's talk for a moment about the Apollo telescope mount, the Solar Observatory. I think if we understand the energy transfer mechanism from the Sun to the Earth better, we are quite likely to learn a lot of things that we've never known about our weather, about radio disturbances and things like this. Even on the Moon, you've read questions, what good are these lunar rocks? Well, the Moon is believed to that it was born at the same time as the Earth, through an accretion process about 4.5 billion years ago. There is no material on Earth that old. In fact, the oldest rock that anybody has ever touched on Earth is about 2 billion years old. The reason that we don't find anything older is that the Earth's surface has been subjected to erosion by an atmosphere, by rain, by wind, by rising and falling continents, by oceans, by volcanic eruptions and so forth, and finally by vegetation. Even plant roots destroy soil and work everything over so nothing is in the shape it was originally. The Moon, having been smaller, probably gelled much faster in its final form, never had an atmosphere, never had an ocean, never had a vegetation, so it has left us a fingerprint of the early state of what the Earth probably was at that time, and it was never changed. So geologists are so excited about the Moon because they say all of a sudden we learn to understand the first half of the geological history of the Earth for which we never had any fingerprint evidence. Now, what good that will do for geological theories, for prospectors ultimately, and so forth, is very hard to tell. But knowledge in itself has always paid off pretty handsomely. I read a very interesting figure the other day that it is estimated that since Archimedes, $30 billion were spent on research in natural, on nature, just to find fundamental truth. In other words, research not oriented at objectives. That's a figure pretty close to the cost of the Apollo program. And that is all the research done since antiquity. Now, we have at the moment roughly $1 trillion a year economy in the United States, a GNP of $900 billion a year. And the rest of the world together produces a GNP of roughly two more trillions. In other words, America is one-third of the total world production. So here you have a world producing a product worth $3 trillion a year. And now ask yourself how much that figure would be had it not been for the $30 billion spent on by Archimedes on basic research. You will probably agree with me that basic research is the smartest investment man has ever made.
Would there be a difference, however, between basic research done where you're on Earth or you're looking at Earth and basic research might be done out of Neptune?
It's very hard to predict what you run into in a discovery. For example, we discovered with outer space observations these new pulsars, which is the most powerful energy source known in the universe. Well, right now nobody can convert pulsars into dollars. But who knows, maybe one fine day, you know, there was a time when thermonuclear energy was solely thought of in terms of hydrogen bombs. I'm convinced that in 10 years we'll make electric power with thermonuclear energy conversion with plasma generators. So these things just take a little longer.
Most of the systems and experiments that you talked of this evening will not really take place for about 10 years. Now, considering the rate of progress that we've been experiencing, is it possible that most of the machinery will become out of date by the time these experiments take place, or that better machinery would be able to be utilized by then?
That is most likely. Everything we've flown in NASA was obsolete by the time it flew. And it was experimental before it flew. So there's no such thing as real up-to-date equipment. By the time it really works well, it's already obsolete, at least in the eyes of advanced planners. Unavoidable, in my opinion.
All the systems you outlined this evening, including the shuttle, all still utilize conventionally fueled rockets. Is there any research currently underway on more exotic things, such as nuclear propulsion or ion engines?
The answer to both questions is yes. We have under development a nuclear rocket engine that produces 75,000 pounds of thrust. It is essentially a graphite reactor with lots of little channels or perforations going through the reactor through which liquid hydrogen is pumped. The reactor, when it goes critical, assumes a white hot temperature, and the hydrogen is heated up to this temperature and then simply expands through a nozzle. Now, due to the very low molecular weight of hydrogen, the exhaust velocity is about twice as high as that of our best hydrogen-oxygen combustion engines. As a result, we can get twice as much thrust with the same propellant consumption. This rocket engine has worked on the test stand repeatedly and for hours. It works quite well, but it doesn't exist yet in a sufficiently light version to fly. It would require quite an additional investment to convert the present, what we call breadboard or battleship type engine, into a flyable piece of hardware. And it would also require more money to build a suitable liquid hydrogen fueled stage for it. Nevertheless, this would be the kind of engine we would be planning to use for manned planetary explorations. And for this reason, we don't want to lose this project. It is one of the projects that many questions have been asked about by the Congress. You see, what else would you use it for except for manned planetary? And it really looks good only for these very long trips involving very heavy payloads. Now, ion engines is a very different thing. An ion engine is an engine that doesn't work with combustion or with heating at all, but where with electrostatic repulsion forces, particles are expelled from the spacecraft and thereby producing a thrust. Now, the velocity at which these particles are expelled is very much higher than what you can do out of a chemical or even a nuclear exhaust. On the other hand, in order to even make a pound of thrust, you have to expel an enormous number of these particles, and you have to handle tremendous currents. So the weight of the machinery developed required to even make a pound of thrust is tremendous, just to create and handle the power conversion equipment, shall we say. You also have to get that power from somewhere. You can even either extract it with solar batteries from the sun, in which case you make a sailing ship, really, out of a spaceship, because you need these tremendous solar collection surfaces, or you need a nuclear reactor that generates power, in which case the conversion equipment becomes, again, very heavy. Now, you may be interested in, is it advantageous to do it or is it not? The answer is, for far-out voyages, for example, to the outer planets, manned as well as unmanned, you can make a good case for the ion propulsion system. What works against you at the moment is that we can also do it chemically, and chemically we have the equipment, and ion propulsion would require additional investments to get it. But we could build the entire Grand Tour scheme with ion propulsion if we spend a little more money in this area. And some people are advocating just that, but I think NASA will decide against it.
It seems to me that lack of funds or difficulty in obtaining funds must be a great frustration to you. And I was just wondering if you could tell us, sort of speculation, what you would do if you were able to have sources of as much funds as you could utilize. With the technology that we have, what do you think you could do with it, say, in 10 years?
Well, I think we have established a pretty good record for spending a lot of money in a very short time on Apollo. I don't think that even several more billion dollars a year would embarrass us in any way. We would very well know how to spend them. On the other hand, I think you shouldn't think of us in NASA as people who are not interested also in getting rid of the beer cans by the roadside or cleaning up our rivers, or that we love smog. We don't. We hate it as much as anyone else, and we also feel strongly that the country has pressing other problems that must be taken care of. So we, and I think the last thing we would ever advocate is to see anybody go hungry so that we can build another gadget for space. What we do believe, however, is that space can make contributions, and very unique contributions, in the long haul that may be, again, in the long haul, far more effective than temporary relief actions. Let me give you just one illustration of a thing that we are doing so that you can see that we are not just dreaming here. In November 1968, NASA, or rather State Department acting for NASA, concluded an agreement with the government of India, under which we are establishing in early 1973 a communication satellite in synchronous orbit over the Indian Ocean. It will be in a 24-hour orbit, hanging, apparently stationary as it goes from west to east, over a meridian that crosses the Indian subcontinent. This will be all that NASA does. Now, the Indian government, on its part of the bargain, will build in the city of Ahmedabad, north of Bombay, a transmitter station capable of emitting two television programs over a beam antenna to this satellite that will be hanging there in the sky all the time, day and night, rain or shine. The satellite will receive this television program, or these two television programs, we'll put them on an amplifier and beam them right back onto India over one big dish antenna continuously aimed at the Indian subcontinent. But this beam is broad enough to cover all of India, the entire subcontinent. And now India itself, on its part of the bargain, will furnish 5,000 village community television receivers that will be located in 5,000 villages in India, where in the morning, for example, for 4 hours, the Indian government plans to use these receivers for schooling purposes. They have a desperate problem with school teachers, and they say, by just getting the kids behind these sets, we will have 4 hours of reading, writing, arithmetic, to fight illiteracy and so forth. And then in the afternoon, they will get the farmers together, and the farmers will be taught what to do about their corn crop. Have you ever heard of hybrid corn? You know, these kind of things. Well, let's get better fertilizer, irrigate your fields more effectively, and so forth. Also, very mundane things, how to get a bank loan to buy fertilizer, and so forth. And there's also 1 hour devoted to what they call family planning, which means how to use the pill, which is something India is understandably very interested in and by no means opposed to learn about. If this experiment is successful, and it will be set up in early 73, the Indian government has already announced that it will establish a communications link for all of India with such direct broadcast television educational satellites, which means that they will not reach 5,000 villages, but all 500,000 villages in India with this means. And instead of having their broadcast system in two languages, namely Hindi and Bengal, they will go to 120 languages and dialects which are spoken in India to really reach everybody. And they have about 500 million people. There will also be a couple of urban booster stations in the Calcutta area and the Madras area and the Bombay area, I believe in New Delhi itself. Now, why is that such an exciting thing for India? This is not because India wants to buy a crazy gadget from NASA. It is really because India cannot solve problems that it desperately must solve. 80% of all Indian villages have no all-weather road connections. More than 80% have no rural electricity. They have no postal service. The school situation is desperate. the hospital situation, hospital advice, this kind of thing is desperate. There are these 120 different languages and dialects, and the basic problem really is a communications problem. The government can't even talk to its own people. On the other hand, to establish a television system like in America, where a guy goes to the bank and borrows $1 million and sets up a booster station and says the soap companies and the detergent manufacturers will maintain the operation due to the commercials. That won't work in India either. Nobody has money enough to buy a television set to begin with, and if he had one, he probably didn't have money to buy detergents. So that mechanism doesn't work either. So they asked us, we hear about all the miracles NASA can do, can you set us up with a broadcast educational television system? And we said, we'll try. And I think NASA is staying very wisely out of the program planning of this. We are not teaching the Indian kids anything. We are not telling the Indians to use the pill. This is what the Indian government will tell them. We will just provide the relay service in this deal. I think it's one of the finest programs we've gone into, and it just gives you another glimpse of the tremendous potential that we have in this thing. Now, if we can tie our Earth resources satellites in with this kind of an educational program, so we can tell the individual Indian farmer, look, Buster, if you just do what your neighbor over there does, you know, 20 miles away, you can quadruple your crop. You may get action. And I think helping these poor countries to help themselves is probably a lot better than put them on relief and send a famine ship to Calcutta every 2 years, you know, and people hear there's another starvation. So I think this thing is really working. This is not dream stuff.
I've been asked to have that be the last question. I'd like to partially answer the last question myself, which was, what would Dr. von Braun really like to do if he had all the money in the world? And the answer is in a little book which he wrote in 1953, and I have in my bookshelf, called The Mars Project, and describes a very detailed and bold adventure of sending an armada of spacecraft with a crew of 70 to really do the job right. Thank you, Bert.